Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah. Immortal Technique. And DJ Green London. Third world motherfucker. I'm from where the golden diamonds are ripped from the earth. Right next to the slave castles where the water is cursed. From where police brutality's not half as nice. It makes the hood in America look like paradise. Compared to the AIDS and best of Caribbean slum. African streets with a passport and American gun. From where they massacre people and try to keep it quiet. And spend the next 25 years trying to deny it. I'm from where they cut your hands off if you make a fist. A nigga stole coca cause the job market doesn't exist. Except slave labor, modern day company store. And peacekeepers don't ever, ever, ever come here no more. From where the bombs that they used to drop on Vietnam still have children born deformed 8 months before they gone. I'm from where they lost the full meaning of the Quran. Cause heroin is not compatible with Islam. And niggas know that, but throw that poppy seed anyway. Cause that food rap parachute does not come every day. I'm from where people pray to the gods of their conquerors. And practically every president's a money launderer. From where the only place democracy's acceptable is if America's candidate is electable. And they might even have a black president, but he's useless cause he does not control the economy, stupid. Lock and load your gun where I'm from, the third world. Son to many places, but I'm third world born. Gorillas didn't run where I'm from, the third world. Son, you polluted everything and now the third world's gone. Water's poison where I'm from, the third world. Son, 700 children died by the end of the storm. Revolution will come where I'm from, the third world. Son, constant occupation leaves the third world torn. I'm from where the Catholic Church is some racist shit. They help Europe and America rape this bitch. They pray to white Spanish Jesus, whose face is this? But never talk about the black Pope Galatius. I'm from where Soviet weapons still decide elections. Militaries like the mafia, you pay for protection. Catamite sex clauses with the country sells. And rich white businessmen make the best clientele. I'm from where they too pussy to come film Survivor. And they murder Coca-Cola union organizers. I'm from where the justice system is stopped. Podrido. Fuck government, niggas politic over Perico. Rebelde conocido, enterrado vivo. Como otro argentino desaparecido. Cause Rico laws don't apply to the CIA. And motherfuckers make sneakers for a quarter a day. I'm from where they overthrow democratic leaders. Not for the people, but for the Wall Street Journal readers. From where blacks, indigenous peoples, and Asians were once slaves of the Caucasians. And it's amazing how they trained them to be racist against themselves in the place they was raised. And you kept us caged and destroyed our culture and said that you civilized us. Raped our women and when we were born, you despised us. Gentrified us, agent provocateur divide us. And crucified every revolutionary messiah. Swarm a start of global riots, it's not even your fake anti-communist dictators to keep quiet. Fuck your charity medicine trying to murder me. The immunizations you gave us were full of mercury. So now I see the third world like the rap game soldier. Nationalize the industry and take it over. Lock and load your gun where I'm from, the third world. Son into many places, but I'm third world born. Gorillas didn't run where I'm from, the third world. Son, you polluted everything and now the third world's gone. The water's poison where I'm from, the third world. Son, 700 children died by the end of the storm. Revolution will come where I'm from, the third world. Son, constant occupation leaves the third world gone.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon. I'll be joined by our correspondent, Andrea Zamudio, who also serves as Your World News Managing Editor. If you haven't heard, we just launched our new website. It is yourworldnews.org. That's yourworldnews.org. Check it out. It's, we're looking for activists who also have a fancy for writing to join our team and to start submitting things that are thought provoking, alternative media type stories and information, much like what we're going to be discussing on this show. So real news, but quite frankly, the news and information that the corporate media purposely, it's not by accident, purposely and methodically omits and marginalizes so that they continue to keep the American public as confused and perplexed and unaware of not just domestic events, but geopolitical events as well. So Andreas, our managing editor, should be joining us for a very robust conversation we're going to have with Stephen Lindman. But yeah, we have a great show today. We have Stephen Lindman on, who is he's a writer, activist. I mean, he's an author. He's I mean, extremely prolific. One of the most prolific columnists I know. Personally, one of the most prolific columnists I know. He's joining us live from Chicago at about half past the hour. And, you know, he's, as I said, he's based in Chicago. He has his own radio show on the Progressive Radio Network. So just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/the-progressive-news-hour. And you can get linked up to his program. But you can also find his information on yourworldnews.org on our blog section. He's published many times, and he's one of our faithful correspondents as well. But he's going to be joining us. We're going to have a very on-time conversation, a very needed, necessary conversation today, as we're going to deconstruct the events of the past week, particularly those events as they relate to Afghanistan, to the ongoing war in Afghanistan, as well as Pakistan, obviously, and the so-called kill of Osama bin Laden, almost 1 week ago. Really, was he really killed that day, or was he dead years before that? Stephen Lindman has published three or four articles, detailing that episode and his research, and he's going to intellectually just undress the corporate media and the U.S. government's account of things, going to break them down with a fine-tooth comb, and hopefully all of you have your critically thinking or your critical thinking caps on. Because the information that Stephen's going to present is very on point and is really hard to deny. So he'll be coming on and we'll be discussing that, as well as getting into the larger scope. What is this fiasco mean? What does this mean in the larger the grand scope? Does it mean that the troops will finally come home? The U.S. troops will finally come back to U.S. shores, or does the U.S. have a longer term aspirations in that region, in Central Asia, for a long time? And remember, especially looking at Pakistan, the U.S. just built about a year or two ago, they completed the construction of a $700 million embassy in Pakistan. And they also have a very large compound in Afghanistan. So when they build those kind of embassies, you best believe that they have long-term intentions. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to get into the ongoing crisis in Libya, otherwise known as U.S. NATO invasion on Libya, false flags, what the real reason is the U.S. is in Libya, and why it's not good for not long-term, why it's not good for the American people, and why it's not good for justice and liberation-oriented people that want to see an end to imperialism, period, seeing an end to this U.S. bullying that we see throughout the globe. So we've got a lot of things going on. But without further ado, I want to bring in Andreas Zamudio. As I said, she is based in Washington, D.C., is a longtime activist, and is also the managing editor for Your World News. Also, she occasionally publishes an article. I've heard a rumor that she's working on another article that should be coming out within the next week or so. So, stay posted for that. And so I just want to welcome Andrea. Andrea, welcome once again to Your World News.
Good morning. Thank you.
You heard the menu that I just laid out in terms of the show, and You know, that's a robust menu for all of our listeners to you know, mentally and intellectually dine on. So it's almost like a buffet. But based on the menu that I laid out, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, I just want to get some of your thoughts on your initial thoughts from last week when you first heard the news that Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. Special Forces, those Navy SEALs.
Well, after I saw the reaction of Americans is really when I started thinking about it. I mean, when I heard he was killed, it was kind of just like, I mean, what point are we getting at with that? That doesn't mean that the war is over. What is the war on terrorism anyways, right? So my reaction was more when I saw all these people cheering and celebrating and saying, you know, USA number one, distraught and quite frankly disgusted because I'm not sure that even, let's just assume that bin Laden was killed this past week, does that justify everything that has happened, the millions of deaths of innocent people, the billions of dollars that our government has spent on these wars?
Right, exactly. Good point. I mean, you don't see exactly. It would be one thing. I would have, you know, far less disdain, you know, for those mental midget Americans just running around. And I have to be hard on them because, you know, they allow themselves to be led to the water and forced to and allow themselves to drink it, you know, without force. They just go there and just drink it up and the next thing you know, they're chanting USA number one. USA number one and what? And
right.
it's just crazy. You know, I remember listening to a lecture by Michael Parenti one time, and he was just talking about like where is this obsessive culture of just of competition, and it's inextricably linked to US's roots of capitalism. You know, capitalism is based on just rugged competition, just rugged individualism. So, you know, we're number one, and on top of that, number one in the most sick things, like number one in global terror, number one, you know, they're talking about number one military to stand out, number one, and never like number one in like human rights, never number one in justice, but it just gets this sick, you know, pathological, just obsession that Americans have and Americanism has in its core of this competition. Number one, we want to have ourselves isolated, and you know, and you continue to allow yourself to be isolated as people of this nation, and you know, you're going to continue to have yourself isolated from the rest of the world, and you're not going to be able to enjoy the world like everyone else because you're going to see it through a very narrow lens, and as you alluded to, you know, it would be one thing if they were consistent and they said, okay, you know, one serial killer is dead. Now we must kill our military as we know it, not like literally kill, but to deconstruct our military as we know it, deconstruct the 700 plus military bases, deconstruct, you know, America's role as just this imperialist, you know, bully that roams throughout the globe looking for the next country to dominate, deconstruct it that way. And what I mean, you know, by deconstructing it and killing it, I mean killing the funding, scaling back significantly the funding for the U.S. military, you know, and putting that difference that comes away from that funding, putting it into real social programs. Right here in D.C., we see social programs, you know, getting cut by the tune of $190 million, you know, that's being proposed by this new mayor in D.C. We see education being slashed across the U.S. We see unions and pension plans being disabled, and we still don't see universal health care. We still don't see universal education on the tertiary level. So we see $800 billion in credit defaults to folks that owe money to student loan lenders and so forth. So yeah, you're right on. It's this conversation that we're about to partake in and having a guest on our program like Stephen Lindman is far and few between and period. But Andreas, you know, how many times are these kind of things laid out on the corporate media? I mean, when is the last time we've heard this kind of discussion, these kind of topics approached, period, not even approached in this way, but approached on the U.S. corporate media, even the U.S. so-called, liberal media, which is like the unicorn. There's no liberal media. I mean, MSNBC is about as liberal as Bill Clinton was. So,
right.
Yeah. So I want to play this clip. Go on.
Oh no, I was just gonna say that it's sad. I mean, what you're talking about, that we don't see different perspectives in corporate media, and you see that reflected in the American people. It's sad that whatever is the topic of the day, people are just regurgitating whatever they heard on the news with so much certainty, like, oh, well, of course he's dead, or of course he was killed in this way. And, they keep switching the story anyways. But it's just interesting how people just eat it up, and they won't be like, oh, that's interesting, but I'd like to hear a different perspective. A lot of people might consider what Mr. Lindman has to say today as a conspiracy theory. But how can you consider something a conspiracy theory without doing your own research, without taking the time to read his perspective and the people that he cites? And the same thing with other people. If we had a variety of people talking about one issue in the corporate media, then people would, be able to make their own judgments about what's going on. But they don't do that for a reason. They only show one perspective, purposefully, so that they can push the agenda that the government wants us to hear, instead of allowing us to hear different points of view and making our own decisions.
You're right. You are right on time with that. It's sick. I mean, so American people, basically, they don't give a damn. They don't give a damn. So all those folks that died on 9/11, all of the people that died on 9/11 on U.S. soil, can be mourned. And rightfully so. Anytime someone dies innocently and is not connected to an altercation and becomes an externality, an externality in terms of a casualty, it is due cause to mourn. But the U.S. in its initial air raids and strikes on Afghanistan, they took more civilians in Afghanistan just initially than were killed on 9/11 on U.S. soil. But there was no mourning for that. It was called, they were called soft target. They were called collateral damage. And now, as we see, tens of thousands of civilians have been killed. Innocent civilians have been killed by way of U.S. drone strikes. By way of U.S. drone strikes, by way of Bush and Obama. Obama's first 72 hours in office, he orchestrated two or three drone strikes. And each time one of those drone strikes occurs, there are civilian casualties that take place. But there's nothing, and the U.S. can just say, oh, we're trying to cut down on civilians. I mean, they don't give a damn about cutting down. I mean, first of all, it's sick, because it's
right.
Like some like sick game. We're gonna cut down. The civilian casualties, as if killing 10 as opposed to killing 20 last week is some kind of market improvement. Damn
right.
It, no. There shouldn't be one innocent civilian killed, period. And
can
so
you imagine if that was
so,
said
of... Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry,
was,
I was just going to say, can
that,
you imagine if that was said of the U.S.?
Oh, yeah, exactly. If someone, instigated some, Exactly. If when Al Qaeda was trying to strike the Pentagon and there were civilians that were killed, and they said, oh, those are just that was just collateral damage. We were just trying to get some of the high ranking officials in the Pentagon. Are you kidding me? It would be all over. I mean, it'd be discussed by everyone from that blowhard Chris Matthews to the white supremacist on Fox News. I mean, just left and right. Oh, this such and such. U.S. I mean, American people have been allowed themselves to be programmed into a point where they have no humanity whatsoever. It's been robbed of them. They've been turned into barbarians. Do not even know it, because they're out there in the streets cheering for this, that, and the other. At the same time, cheering, basically, for the death and destruction of civilians in Iraq, Afghanistan, in Pakistan. They say nothing about it. Yes, so you have little pockets of folks here and there, like us and different activists, you know, throughout the country. But let's be frank. They're far and few between. And I'm going to get into this. We're going to get into this with Stephen. Is the importance of like mass demonstrations on a very large scale. So Andre, I want to play this, and let's I'm going to play this clip, and I want you to think, you know, and I want folks to think long and hard. This perspective, which comes from Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report, how many, you know, when the U.S. started to do airstrikes in Libya, and they were talking about civilians, where in the U.S. media have they even mentioned anything about the continued targeting of Black Africans in Libya and their continued the continued massacring of Black Africans? So let's play this and then, you know, get your feedback afterwards.
The rebels in Benghazi have rejected an African Union delegation proposal for a ceasefire in Libya, a plan that was accepted by Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi over the weekend. The reaction in Benghazi was no surprise. The five heads of state from Mauritania, Mali, Congo-Brazzaville, Uganda, and South Africa would have been chased down the streets and lynched by mobs had the Western news media not been watching. So rabid is the anti-black hysteria whipped up by the rebel political leadership. If anyone needs protection in rebel-held Libya, it is people with dark skin, hundreds of whom have been murdered for no offense other than their color. Spokesmen for the Rebel Transitional Council claim to be fighting phantom black African armies, mirages that do not exist, a despicable use of race as a tool of war. In reality, the rebels are not in a position to accept or reject anything. Whatever their political composition may have been when protests against the government in Tripoli began back in February, they are now totally dependent minions of the United States and Europe. They have chosen to become soldiers of an Arab counter-revolution in the service of imperialism. What kind of revolution, what kind of Arab nationalism is it that begs for intervention and close air support from the imperial superpower? The African Union heads of state had to seek approval for their delegation from the European Union, according to the BBC. Western media dismissed the peace mission as suspect, many of them referring to the African Union as a club for the benefit of African rulers. If that is so, it is a circumstance that Africans will deal with. The actual club that threatens Black Africa and Arab Africa and all the world's people is the Euro-American Club. France, Britain, Belgium, the United States, and the other world enslavers that are joined in the hyper-aggressive military club called NATO, the most dangerous club on the planet. The African Union proposal called for an immediate ceasefire, suspension of NATO airstrikes, a dialogue between the Gaddafi government and the rebels, unhindered delivery of humanitarian aid, and protection of foreign nationals. The last item points to the obscene behavior of the rebels and their European overseers, especially. 3 million foreign workers did the manual labor that kept Libya's economy going so that 6 million Libyans could enjoy the highest standard of living by far on the African continent. Half of those foreign workers, 1.5 million, are black Africans, whose abuse in rebel-held areas since February will stain the national honor of Libya for a generation. The Euro-Americans also bear responsibility for the migrant workers' plight as self-appointed protectors of Libya's civilian population. Yet they have failed to maintain a safe corridor to Egypt for the hunted and despised black Africans, making a mockery of the United Nations resolution and showing the NATO war for what it really is, a neo-colonial crusade. The real heroes in any 21st century war are those who are willing to stand up to the full spectrum domination of U.S. air power. Gaddafi's soldiers have earned the respect of all those that do not worship at the altar of imperial power. The Libyan rebel leaders have chosen to be pawns in someone else's great game. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to...
And, yeah, that was Glenn Ford. And, Andre, I want to get your your thoughts on that. I've got several, but I want to get your thoughts on what you just heard.
Right. So, I mean, it's sick. You don't see that covered at all in the media. There's no talk of the black Africans, the darker-skinned Africans in Libya and what they're going through. You know, it's telling of the racism that we see across the board in the media.
Right, right, and it's been going on. And the funny thing is that the U.S. We discussed this some weeks ago. I believe Peter Fowler and I discussed this several weeks ago. It's just that, you know, most Americans can't even point out Libya on a damn map, was it in their consciousness before that? And so most Americans would think would tell you that Libya is in the Middle East, you know, mm-hmm. and Maghreb is a totally foreign word to most Americans, to the vast majority of Americans. You know, so, you know, to think that it's really pathetic. It's like Pavlov's dogs. They just, you know, they do what you tell them to. I mean, they, you know, you could, if something happened, you know, in Micronesia, I mean, they would just jump on it if the U.S.,
right.
you know, U.S. media told them to, let alone, I mean, there's no way on earth the vast majority of Americans could even point to that archipelago. So the same goes with Libya. And so they're like, oh my gosh, yeah, this guy was such and such a dictator, this and the other. And as we've discussed, is that, you know, you look at all the leaders in that region and throughout the Maghreb, and then even expanding to the Middle East. I mean, Gaddafi would rank, you know, at the very bottom of that list in terms of people that you know, one would term as tyrants or dictators or this, that, and the other. Libya, you know, the people in Libya have the highest living standards in all the continent of Africa. They have things that Americans don't have. They have free health care, universal health care, affordable housing, vastly affordable housing. Are given loans from the government that they don't have to pay back, these kind of things. Is it a perfect society? No. I mean, is the U.S.'s society perfect? No. These are things that we strive as a global society to better humanity for everybody. But to deem him what the U.S. was describing him was a farce, and it's far deeper than that. It's because of the things that, you know, that because Gaddafi was, you know, the things that he was trying to do with the Libyan dinar. He was trying to use the Libyan and is trying to use the Libyan dinar as the trading currency for folks that, you know, Western countries and countries throughout the world that want to use their oil. And so, you know, as we know, gold is much more tangible than this, the falling dollar. And so that raised an ire. Obviously, the oil is huge. The great aquifer that they have underneath Libyan soil, the aquifer, which is like enough water to, you know, and Stephen Lindman has written a lot about this as well. But it's enough enough water to basically, you know, quench the thirst of folks throughout the world until I can't remember. Maybe you know, Stephen will get more into that. But it's decades, you know, in the future. I mean, these are the kind of things that made Gaddafi, you know, public enemy number one. He's long been pushing for the United States of Africa, unity throughout the continent of Africa. So as I said before, you know, based on the leaders in that, in the Maghreb and also throughout the Middle East, in terms of tyrants or dictators, he would be at the bottom list. I mean, he would be far below what Israel has been doing to Palestinians. He's far below, you know, what has been going on in Bahrain. We see mass killings in Bahrain. U.S. ain't doing a damn thing intervene there. We know that Bahrain is an ally to the U.S. and has long been an ally to U.S. So even though Syria is not an ally to the U.S., we see hundreds and hundreds of people being massacred in Syria. No intervention there. And it's not. And actually, when I'm saying this, I'm not actually one that pushes for U.S. intervention, because U.S. intervention does not usually bode well for citizens in that country. It just doesn't. You know, U.S. engagements since the last several U.S. engagements, military engagements. You know, whether it's been Panama or Grenada, Vietnam, 94 to 96% of the people killed have been civilians. So, anyways, I see that Stephen Lindman is on the line, and once again, I want to introduce Stephen Lindman. He writes for several publications, including Your World News. He's extremely prolific. I mean, he's an individual who is not just an author, not just a writer, but he's an activist and has long devoted his life towards activists, to truth, justice, and he's not afraid. He's not afraid to speak out against injustice, even when it's at the hands of his own. Can we actually say that this is our own government, or as a government in terms of the country in which he and we all reside? And so without further ado, I want to bring Stephen Lindman on. Stephen, can you hear us? You're on with
Solomon
and Andrea.
I sure can, Solo. It's really great to be on with you. You're right. I'm very concerned about what's going on. The more I learn, the more reason I know everyone should have good reason to be disturbed, because literally our government, and it doesn't matter whether it's a Republican or a Democrat-run government, it's a duopoly. It's really more or less a one-party state with two wings. And they don't work for the people. They really work against the people, and they work only for the small elitist segment of society. So they benefit very nicely, but the great majority, and that majority keeps growing and growing and growing, they are doing very poorly to, in the case of so many, being seriously in trouble economically, socially, and so on. And what kind of a country does this? Certainly not a democracy.
Right. So we thank you so much. We can't wait to get into this dialogue. And Andrea Zamudio is my co-host for the day, so she'll be asking you some questions as well. But I want to start off, Stephen, with a question. You've written a lot of pieces since the so-called alleged, kill and capture of Osama bin Laden's body, and then the subsequent dumping into the sea. But you've written some pretty controversial things. And when I say controversy usually means truth in the U.S. Why do you write in your pieces that bin Laden was killed, or was dead, I should say, long before the U.S. said that they killed him last week?
Well, the great scholar who'll be on my program later in May, and he was last year sometime, David Ray Griffin, he has really done the seminal work on 9/11, exposing 9/11 as what I call the big lie of our time. And I've referred to the so-called bin Laden assassination on May Day, the big lie of the moment. And he wrote a book on he wrote four or five books on 9/11, and in 2009 he wrote a book that he called Osama bin Laden Dead or Alive, and he presented powerful evidence, extremely convincing, that bin Laden was a very ill man. That's an indisputable fact. He was a very, very ill man going back over a decade ago. Kidney failure, diabetes, probably other ailments. The idea that he was hiding in a cave is it would be ludicrous if it wasn't such a serious situation while he was still living. He never would. I don't know about never, but certainly not when we began vilifying him. He was not hiding in a cave. Around the 9/11 incident, he was not in a cave. In fact, on CBS News, Solo, I believe after the fact, I wrote that Dan Rather, when he was the anchor of CBS News, reported on September 10th, 2001. I think, in fact, he reported that on September 10th, 2001, Bin Laden was in a Rawalpindi, Pakistan hospital on dialysis. And then, unrelated to that report, Le Figaro newspaper in Paris wrote that in July 2001, Bin Laden was in a Dubai hospital on dialysis, and get this, he was visited in his hospital room by the Emirates CIA station chief. Well, the obvious question is, why on earth would any CIA person visit Bin Laden? And if they knew where he was, this was before 9/11, but you would think that they at least might have had suspicions that he was not what they would call a good guy. Well, after 9/11, he became, quote-unquote, enemy number one. But all along until he died, he was also a CIA asset, recruited through Pakistan's ISI, their intelligence, in the 1980s to fight the Soviets. The people we call the Taliban and Al-Qaeda today, with a heroic Mujahideen in the 1980s that Ronald Reagan called freedom fighters. So they changed from being freedom fighters to Al-Qaeda terrorists. Well, I mean, same type people. You know, the ones in the 1980s, many of them may not be around anymore, or maybe they've gotten too old, but the latter generation today, same type people doing the same types of things. And these people are in Libya right now. We can talk about that during the program. These same type people are in Libya, comprising a lot of these so-called rebels. But in any event, Bin Laden had nothing whatsoever to do with 9/11. David Ray Griffin, in his book, just made such a convincing case, presenting so much evidence, including noted people admitting that Gaddafi had died around mid-December 2001. Number one, on 9/11, Bin Laden gave three interviews before he died to Al Jazeera. On all of them, he said, I had no knowledge of or any involvement in the 9/11 attack. But Al Jazeera misquoted him, I have to believe deliberately. I mean, he gave three interviews saying exactly the same thing. And I saw a couple of them. I mean, the quote had no ambiguity to it. Al Jazeera twisted what he said and claimed that he admitted involvement in 9/11. So that became the official story, or the official lie, that Bin Laden was behind it. Well, he had nothing whatsoever to do with it. And of course, to make a long story short, on 9/11, it was an inside job. It had nothing to do with quote-unquote crazed Arabs that we blamed for this event. But Griffin named very prominent people who years ago admitted that Bin Laden was dead. Among them, two former presidents of Pakistan, Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto, before she was killed, Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan, a former FBI head of counterterrorism, also several former CIA agents, saying things like, oh, of course he died. And other people as well saying the same thing. By the way, in my new article today, Solo, CNN really goofed. the Elliot Spitzer program after the May Day attack interviewed the former head of Pakistan's intelligence service, their ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence, their equivalent of our CIA, a man named Hamid Ghul. And CNN never intended to hear him say what he did. But he also, I quoted him verbatim, he also said, Bin Laden died years ago. Now, that went right over U.S. airwaves, where, I mean, he just destroyed the official story, but you can bet you they're going to burn that tape.
Yeah, definitely. Andrea?
I wanted you to expand. Well, welcome to the show again.
Thank you, Andrea.
I wanted you to expand on, I've heard some things about Al Jazeera claiming that they're going to release a film by Al-Qaeda showing that Bin Laden is still alive. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, what you think about that. And given that, you know, you stated that Al-Qaeda officials attended his funeral in 2001.
Oh, well, that's a very important topic, I must say. I read, and this was in my article today, I read that not a video, but an audio recording, but, you know, audio, video, in other words, a live statement by Bin Laden admitting something that absolutely was untrue. I wrote before, and I wrote again after the May Day incident, that the so-called videos and audios that came out after 9/11 were fake. They were fake. An expert at forensically analyzing videos and audios, in particular, took a very close look at two of them, one in 2004 and one in 2007. And his analysis concluded that they weren't just fakes. They were sloppy fakes, including audio ones saying the words were spliced together. And he concluded that he didn't even think that Bin Laden was speaking them, that someone else was imitating him, and they were splicing comments together. So the audios were fake, the videos were fake. Oh, I absolutely expect either a video or an audio or something or other to come out, but you can betcha that it will be phony. It'll air on U.S. television. And all of the media will jump on it to say, aha, we told you so. We got the guy. but don't believe it for a minute. I mean, they put this stuff out, and it is absolute rubbish.
Right. Stephen, what does this mean for the, what does this mean for long-term presence in Afghanistan? You hear, like, certain rumblings, and I totally don't buy it, where people are saying, oh, well, you know, we can expect to see an acceleration of troop withdrawal and the troops coming home. I totally don't think. I think it just means that they're going to be there even longer. But what research have you done around this? Can you disclose what you believe the U.S. presence in Central Asia is going to be from this period on?
Well, I would say categorically, Solo, there's not a chance that we're pulling out of Afghanistan or Iraq. I'll tell you what I think is going to happen. It's going to be a head fake. They'll probably announce some kind of a withdrawal, but it'll be so inconsequential it won't matter. So I don't know the exact number of troops there now. I know Obama, I think, tripled the number over George Bush. It's over 100,000. He might pull a few thousand out, you know, a nominal pullout to make it look like he's keeping his promise. But there isn't one chance in 1,000 that we're pulling out of Afghanistan or Iraq. And the analogy I like to use is think back to World War II. That war was over, my math is 65 years ago.
Right.
We're still in Germany, we're still in Japan, we're still in South Korea, but that's not bad enough. We had a certain number of bases back then that in total was a shadow of our bases now. We have well over 1,000 bases worldwide, maybe in 130 or 40 or 50 countries. Who knows? The Pentagon numbers lie. They put out this data, but they don't tell all. So it could be there's roughly 190-odd countries in the world, maybe close to 200, and we're in maybe as many as 75% of them with military bases. So we'll shift the bases around every now and then. We might close one down, but open another one someplace else, something like that. Or maybe close one down and build two more. So a decade ago, we certainly weren't in Iraq, and we weren't in some other Middle East countries. But we're all over the Middle East now, and once they get rid of Gaddafi in Libya, they absolutely want to open up U.S. bases to intimidate other regional countries. I think they're already intimidated. My God, they know what happened to Iraq, and they see what's happening to Gaddafi right now. I mean, that will scare the daylights out of anybody to not want to take on Fortress America, or they'll get a taste of some of the same thing. But the idea that we're pulling out of these countries is no chance in the world.
All right, Andrea?
Mr. Lumen, in an interview with RT, you stated that this announcement was not released at this time to increase Obama's popularity for the 2012 election. So what do you think politically and economically this announcement is strategic for the U.S. right now?
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I think some people have been interviewed, and they said that, yeah, he did want to get a boost for the 2012 election. But that election is a long ways away, a year and a half from now. And generally, people will vote their pocketbook, not some foreign policy issue, unless they're very angry. Back in the Vietnam days, there was an awful lot of public anger about that war. People wanted it ended, but we had a draft back then. It was a different situation, and lots of people that were in the military, not because they wanted to be. So that was a different scenario. But you could compare Afghanistan to Vietnam in terms of the length of these wars, and you would think that people in this country would be very angry about these things going on with the enormous amounts of money being spent, which means they are suffering because badly needed benefits back home are not being taken care of. But they're not. The anti-war movement is really slumbering. It really is. It's very shameful, and people don't realize that they will never get anything improving in their lives unless they get active enough to be vocal and complain and not just show up at a protest every now and then. In my opinion, it's too late for protests. It's time for action. When Election Day rolls around, people will vote their pocketbooks. So if they've lost their home and they can't find a job or a decent job, that's going to be issue number one with them, not some so-called terrorist who we claim isn't alive anymore, and I agree with that, not some foreign war, which I think we should be more concerned about. They will vote the economic situation at home, and I don't know what it'll be a year or so from now, but my sense is it will not be better. It'll be worse. So, and I also think, regardless of that, the bump that Obama got in the polls will quickly fade. By the way, a good analogy was George Bush Sr., who during the Gulf War got a very sharp bump. Talk about a sharp bump. I don't know what it was before the bump began, but his approval rating shot up to 90%. I'm talking about Bush 1. Bush 2, same, after 9/11, Bush 2's approval rating shot up to 90%. But just take Bush 1, 90%. But he peaked too early. And, of course, the 92 election came along and he lost.
All right.
So do you feel that this is a distraction, that this announcement right now is just a distraction from the issues that are happening at home, you know, all the economic issues that people are facing? You know, it's just this announcement is being used to distract the people from focusing and organizing around these issues?
Oh, I think temporarily it is a distraction. And, of course, Obama got the popularity bump, and people are focusing on this bad guy. And why they worry about this, I don't know. Well, they connect him with 9/11. I guess that's why they worry about it. So, you know, if there was one bad terror attack and he was responsible, and if he's still around, then why can't there be another one just as bad or maybe worse? So they do worry about that. And maybe it won't be in New York. Maybe it'll be in the city where they live. So people worry about all kinds of things I call nonsensical. I mean, don't get out on the highway and drive. I mean, worry that somebody will hit you and kill you or hurt you badly. Well, I mean, it doesn't stop you from driving or any number. Don't step off the curb because maybe some speeder or a drunk driver will get you or something like that. Worry about the important things like your government betraying you and your welfare in the country is not improving, but it's eroding. Those are the things to worry about. Those are real issues. And then ask yourself why and realize it's because government is not serving you. Government is serving elitist interests and harming you because they do so much for them at your expense. But people don't think that way. But, temporarily there's a distraction from the economic distress. I think the bigger issue is that instead of using this event as a reason for less militarism, for a drawing down foreign wars, it'll be used as an excuse for more, not less. That's what I see coming. And the rationale will be something like, there could be a number of things, but one thing is that, Al-Qaeda's still around or other terrorists are still around, and they're very angry that we killed bin Laden. So we can expect revenge attacks. So we have to be extra vigilant, which means what? More repressive laws, more Patriot Acts, more cops in the streets, more all kinds of terrible things we're doing at home, maybe more foreign wars. Is that what they have in mind? Well, I think maybe that's exactly what they have in mind.
Right. Stephen, you said something. You triggered me to think about something in your response a few minutes ago, and you were talking about the fact that Americans vote their pocketbooks, and then you followed by saying that these wars, should be more important to Americans right now than their pocketbooks, and I really couldn't agree with you more, because what Americans fail to do is to connect military expenditure to their pocketbooks and certain government resources that they should be getting, universal health care, the adequate funding of schools and these types of things that are complete absence in American society today. And it seems that a lot of folks just don't, and this is planned, that they don't think about these things, but they don't think about these things being connected to the trillion plus dollars that are spent per annum on the military from their taxes. Is that kind of what you were alluding to?
Oh, absolutely. Partially? Absolutely. There's so much money in the pot to spend. And the more we spend bailing out bankers and spending on foreign wars and building military bases around the world, the less there is to address to domestic social needs. So, the budget debate going on in Congress, and I absolutely believe both parties are in lockstep. Only their rhetoric differs. Republicans are very in your face. We have to cut and slash and so on. And Democrats are more low-key. They're softer. They want to go a different way. But I think when they sit down together, and we're not there or there are no reports about it, they basically agree that they will end up doing the same thing. Maybe only the timing will differ. So the compromise will be on the timing, not the final objective they want to achieve, which I believe literally is to end the key entitlements. I am absolutely convinced they're going to do it by stealth. Or in one of my articles, I said they'll do it by 1,000 cuts. Literally, they want to end Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And this is really disgusting. And they lie about them, and they say they're in trouble. Well, they're not in trouble. They're not in trouble. And they never mention important things like Medicare and Social Security are insurance plans. Anybody who works pays for these things. And if you don't work, you don't get Social Security. And I think you don't get Medicare either, because you and your employer pay for these in payroll tax deductions. So I call it what it is, an insurance plan. So you pay your premiums during your working life, and my feeling is we signed a contract. The contract was we'll pay our premiums, and when we reach retirement age, which they're raising, I think they're doing it illegally, but they're doing it. For me, it was 65. On retirement, you will get your benefits. Well, I'm getting mine, although they're getting less and less all the time. My Social Security is miscalculated in terms of inflation, but I get a monthly Social Security check. I get my Medicare, but they raise the price to me because there's a Medicare Part A and Part B. Part A is free, no cost. But if you want to get the big expenses covered, like hospital bills and so on, you got to have Part B. Well, they keep raising the amount of my share of the cost of this every year. And that wasn't the contract I signed. I signed a contract that I'll get this insurance, my health care taken care of when I retire. Well, now they're charging me. I have to spend about $1,000 a month on two things, on my Part B fees that I pay, and because Medicare does not cover all medical expenses, which, again, wasn't part of the contract I signed. They don't cover all of the expenses, so I have to buy a supplemental policy to cover things if I have a serious illness. Otherwise, I would be stuck with huge, huge bills. So you put it together, and I don't think it's $1,000. I'm going to have to go back and check it. It's hundreds of dollars a month that I have to spend for what I thought I'd be getting at no cost because I paid my insurance premiums, going back to when Medicare first began in the mid-1960s. So I was part of that system from the very, very beginning. They want to end those plans.
Right. Yeah, they do. What is their motive for ending them?
Because they don't give a damn about helping people socially. They want to use the country's wealth solely for America's aristocracy, including fighting more wars, corporate subsidies, those kinds of things, and assuring that the rich people in the country get richer while the poor people get poorer and the middle class is wiped out completely. The middle class in the last couple of decades has been seriously hit, and the real attack on the middle class began actually in the late 1970s under Jimmy Carter. He turned from a little bit more left of center to right of center his last 2 years as president. And then they really kicked into overdrive under Ronald Reagan. So for the last 32, 33 years, there has been a war against America's working class and working Americans generally. And there's been a tremendous wealth transference from ordinary people, the great majority of people in the country, to the better off and mostly the super rich. So they're doing just fine, but ordinary people are having a very, very hard time, and it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. So the official numbers say we have an economic recovery, but I say point blank what I believe is absolute fact. We have a Main Street depression going on. And it's going to go on year after year. I don't see the end of it.
Right. Thank you. And I have another question that correlates with that because you mentioned healthcare, which we don't have here in the U.S. You know, we have 44,000 Americans each year that die simply because they do not have health insurance. And I want to link this to Libya and the pieces that you've been writing on Libya for quite some time now. I just saw the interview with Lawrence O'Donnell, you know, the week interview that he gave with Condoleezza Rice, if it was a real interview, he would have pressed her much harder, but basically let her off the hook. But she basically went in, when asked about, Iraq, she compared it to Libya. It's like, she's like, we had to go into, you know, Obama had to go into Libya because Gaddafi was you know, was about to start a genocide, and you know, we went into Iraq because of the intelligence. And she's like, yes, now we know the intelligence was not as good as we thought. But once we got there, we felt it was our job to help the people of Iraq, you know, find democracy, which is funny. A million plus civilian lives, a million plus Iraqi civilians dead later. I would hate if that democracy were ever brought to me. But my question for you, Stephen, is this pretext. We continue to hear this pretext about Libya, and it completely goes unchecked in the corporate media. And so I want you to deconstruct this completely. What was the real pretext for the U.S. So-called intervention, for the U.S. Bombing, and now the NATO bombing of Libya, and their disdain for Gaddafi?
Oh, well, that's a big topic. Overall, Solo, every time we fight a war, it absolutely has nothing to do with humanitarian reasons. That's always the bogus reason giving. Or in the case of Iraq, we talked about WMDs, Afghanistan, the terrorists that caused 9/11. It's all part of the big lie. You have to scare the U.S. public. You have to make them believe that you're going in for a reason other than the real one or the real ones. And very simply, whenever anybody from government tries to explain why they're doing something and the reasons they give, every single time they are lying. They are lying. And you could go back. All the wars that America has fought, they were all based on lies. Even the so-called good war, World War II wasn't a good war. It was the worst war. It was the worst war by far. It kills somewhere, who knows how many people were killed, but somewhere between 40 and 60 million people were killed, and mostly civilians. You mentioned in your introductory comments, I mean, civilians pay the biggest price, and that's right. In every single war, more civilians are killed than combatants. But in a word, why we fought all these wars, the recent ones, Afghanistan, Pakistan as well. We're at war in parts of Pakistan. I mean, we're bombing them with drones every single day. Even ground forces are on the ground attacking certain parts of the country. The general reasons we go to war come down to maybe three things. Power, profits, and unchallengeable hegemony over the areas that we're attacking. Nothing to do with humanity, nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, nothing to do with any of the things that they tell us. There are always specifics in a country as well. So Gaddafi and Saddam shared at least one common crime in our eyes. They wanted to get off of the dollar. They wanted to sell their oil in a currency other than the dollar. In Saddam's case, he wanted to switch from dollars to euros. In Gaddafi's case, he wanted to switch to either a gold standard using Libyan dinars, or simply trade them in Libyan dinars. And Libya, oh, let me get down. I mean, that was a big item. Petrodollar recycling back to this country is extremely important. Number one, to keep the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And number two, to have foreign central banks, and all of them, as a matter of fact. But the Gulf states, I mean, they're selling hundreds of billions of dollars worth of oil. And if all of this is sold in dollars, then you recycle the dollars back. What are you going to do with all these dollars? These countries are not super developed. They're really, most of them are very underdeveloped. So, I mean, you get all of this money, like Saudi Arabia. I mean, what on earth, how on earth could you spend all this money at home? Well, you can't. Country population-wise is fairly small. You've got some bigger countries, but I think the biggest ones aren't really oil-rich or have much oil at all, like Egypt, the biggest country population-wise in the Middle East, North Africa. What are you going to do with all of this money? Well, we want it recycled back to this country, either by things like weapons buying, investments in U.S. Industries, buying U.S. Treasuries, long bonds or shorter-term maturities. In other words, recycle that money back here so we can use it for the things we want to spend our money on. Well, if these countries don't trade in dollars, there's no recycling. and the dollar can lose its reserve currency status, world reserve currency status. That was a big reason. I wrote an article, and I included other reasons in it, too. Another big one was related to the dollar issue. Gaddafi had the Central Bank of Libya, owned by the state, printing its own money, interest-free, and using it to develop Libya and for social benefits for the Libyan people. Now, Gaddafi was a despot. I make no bones about that. But if you had to live under a despot, you would want him. It's usually a him. I guess it could be a woman, and there have been some female despots, but it's usually a man. So I'll say him. You would rather live under him than probably any other despot you could think of. And the second one after him, you would want to live under Saddam, because they both did a lot of the same things: free education, free health care. And Gaddafi did some remarkable things. I was stunned when I found this out. He wanted all Libyans housed, so he devoted resources to building housing. Newlyweds, this one really shocked me, newlyweds got a stipend, a rather generous stipend, to start them off in married life. Students who wanted to study abroad, he paid for their education and, I believe, expenses as well. you think America does anything like that? My God. Wow. We never, during the best times we ever had, we never did anything like that. But these are some of the things that Gaddafi did. So those were no-nos. So one of the first things that was done, and Libya now really is effectively split in two. You've got the so-called rebel-controlled area in Benghazi in the east, and you've got the Tripoli Gaddafi-controlled area in the west. So I guess he still has his Central Bank of Libya, but I don't know what it's doing, because we stole his resources. That I saw one estimate that went up to possibly $150 billion. We stole that money. Stole it. We'll use it ourselves for whatever we want. You know, arm the rebels. Most, you know, you don't need $150 billion to arm rebels. We can just give them the weapons, but we'll use it to spend here in this country. Again, do what we want with it. And then they began, well, you know, the people who came, the Western folks who came in, America, France, and UK mainly, set up the Central Bank of Benghazi, run by not the state, but by Western bankers. Just the way the Federal Reserve is operated. The Federal Reserve is not federal. It's a private banking cartel run by Wall Street. So it forces the government literally to pay interest on its own money, and it violates the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. If the government printed its own money, it would get all the money it wanted interest free. Well, right now is an anomaly. Right now it is practically interest free. But that is a very, very strange time, and interest rates are kept down abnormally and wrongfully, because it is circulating an awful lot of money. that is being used not for economic growth but for speculation. And this has another bad ending down the road, but it's another topic. But those were two of the reasons. I mean, there are other reasons as well. He opted out of AFRICOM. AFRICOM mm-hmm. is the U.S. Pentagon command for that part of the world, and only five African countries opted out. Libya was one of them. That was a no-no. He promoted the idea of Pan-Africanism yes. to unite African countries to basically be a more powerful force to serve their own interests, develop their own countries. And Libya being a very rich country from all the oil, he was financing some of the poorer states, doing things for them, again, things that we don't do. You know, we want to sell them weapons and do things like that, but we don't hand them our money. Well, Gaddafi was financing them to benefit them. So you get these and you've got other issues. In a nutshell, as I think people in this country would put it, officials in this country, he wasn't, quote-unquote, with the program. He didn't buy the U.S. neoliberal model, and he was an outlier. And because he wasn't going our way, we wanted him out. And I believe the plan to oust him goes back years. We may have just begun it. The bombing began March 19th, and maybe the rebel insurgency, it's not a revolution, it's an insurgency, Western-backed, financed, armed, that began maybe so many weeks or a few months before that. But before that began, you didn't have a word about bad guy Gaddafi. But I believe the plan has been in the works for years. Even though he came in from the cold in 2003, I don't think we ever embraced him. We try to get out of him whatever we could, you know, let the big corporations come in, let them have the oil contracts or whatever. And so we got what we could and bided our time. And he also admitted to something he had no involvement in, and that was the Pan Am 103 downing. And the poor guy who went to prison, Mizrahi, he had nothing whatsoever to do with it. And he admitted to it as the price to pay to come in from the cold and then pay a few billion dollars in settlement to the people who were affected. Well, the CIA down Pan Am 103, not Gaddafi. The CIA should have anteed up the billions of dollars, and they should have been put in the prison that Mizrahi was put in, but that they were the fall guys, and then they admitted to it. So that's the official story. But the true story was, and Gaddafi has done a lot of bad things, but one thing he did not do was down Pan Am 103.
Thanks.
Mr. Lemon, thank you for the tremendous amount of context that you put Libya in. We have a couple callers, and I just wanted to ask you
sure.
if you're okay with taking a brief question
yeah.
or comment. Okay.
Okay. Caller, line one, you're on. You have a brief question or comment for Mr. Stephen Lindman? Caller? I guess, hello? All right. I guess they're... So Andre, you can ask me a question. I guess maybe they got camera shy or microphone shy. Andre.
I just wanted to go back a little bit to Bin Laden, and you know, if the actual intent of this war was to end the so-called war on terror, wouldn't it be in the best interest for the judicial system and the various departments to fall under the guise of the national security to question Bin Laden? You know, usually. A criminal is interrogated to see, you know, how the crime was committed and how to prevent future crimes from occurring. And so it's just interesting that, you know, assuming that they killed him recently, you know, why would they throw his body? Why would Navy SEALs that are trained so well kill him instead of capturing him and interrogating him and getting more information about Al-Qaeda and the other heads of Al-Qaeda?
Oh, absolutely. And another big point. On the one hand, according to international law and our own law, everybody is entitled to due process and judicial fairness. And if somebody is accused, they have not yet been convicted. So they are innocent until or unless they are convicted by a judicial proceeding. So if somebody is suspected of something, then certainly we might have a right to try to capture them and bring them to justice, not go in and shoot somebody. I'm sure that somebody or maybe a number of people were killed in this raid. Again, it was not to get bin Laden, but there absolutely was a raid because people in that area heard gunshots, and I think there were explosions. So something did go on. It just wasn't what we were told it was. But by going in and killing anybody without cause, we violated our own law and we violated constitutional law. And I wrote about that in one of my articles. And I quoted law professors explaining that that no nation can be judge, jury, and executioner. You can arrest a suspect and then bring them to trial and let the evidence speak for itself. And if guilty, then let a judge pronounce a sentence or a jury or whatever, however it would work. But do it according to law, and we did not do that in this raid. So we killed people, I'm sure, and we did it extrajudicially. Extrajudicially. And, of course, we do this all the time. I mean, every time we have a drone attack and kill people, you know, we're supposedly targeting, quote-unquote, terrorists. Most of the time we kill civilians. But, I mean, you cannot target anybody you accuse of terrorism or anything else. You should capture them. And if they're in another country, you should ask the other country to do the capturing. What right do we have to go into the sovereign territory of another country and conduct a violent raid? What right do we have to send our military forces unannounced, uninvited, into another country for any reason, to go and get a Coca-Cola? What right do we have to do that? We have no right. You need to have the permission of the sovereign country to come, and most of these countries require a visa. If you or I want to visit most countries in the world, we would need visa permission from that country to be able to come. If you want to go to Western Europe, I don't know what they're doing now post 9/11, but before 9/11, you didn't need a visa, and the borders were open. The one time I was in Europe, you could just drive from one country to another. They would stop you and as you crossed over and maybe ask you something like, how long are you going to be here, or what are your plans? But, 10, 15 seconds, and bingo, you go right through. But now maybe there are visas in countries where you didn't have to have them before. But most countries of the world, I believe you do need a visa to come in. So nobody has a right, including the official forces or representatives of a government, without permission to come. And, of course, we never do that. We just barge in. And in our case, we barge in so often the gun's blazing. So we just violate the law with impunity and do whatever we want to do and claim just cause. So I mean we compound the terrible lawlessness that we commit by saying just cause. You know, we were getting rid of bad guys. Who are these bad guys? According to whom? And one more thing about bin Laden, even with the official story, they kept changing and changing and changing. But right now, there's nobody, no photos, no video, and no evidence. Mm-hmm. I don't know how anybody can believe that we killed a guy named bin Laden with none of that to prove it.
Exactly. Exactly. You touched on the drone attacks. I wanted to – we know that, you know, in Pakistan, you know, there's a U.S. puppet there in the presidency by the name of Asif Ali Zardari. And we also know that there's a puppet in Afghanistan with Hamid Karzai. But what are the implications, the deeper – because we see the U.S. continuing to ratchet up the drone attacks, especially in Pakistan, North Waziristan, and other parts of Pakistan. What can we see, what is the immediate to long-term forecast of these drone attacks in relationship to the people? My thinking is that every time one of these drone attacks occurs, it makes the recruitment for young men to become more militant, more radicalized, and it makes it much easier for them to step into the Pakistani wing of the Taliban. But also beyond that, it seems like right now, in terms of the stories that came out this week, is that the more and more Pakistani people, men, women, and children, are extremely, extremely, I mean, and they don't talk about this on the corporate media, but extremely disgruntled is such a euphemistic word, for lack of a better one I'm thinking of, but are extremely angered at their own government for being in cahoots with the U.S. in terms of allowing the U.S. to do what they're doing with these drone attacks without a much stronger stance. But it seems like the government is soon, the Pakistani government is soon going to either have to, answer to the calls and the cries of its people to put pressure on the U.S. to stop these, or it's going to be toppled. And, we could see a domino effect. But I just wanted to kind of get your insight in terms of what the long-term and the short-term ramifications of these drone attacks. And you know, obviously the immediate ones are that the long-term is that, you know, you have civilians who are wiped off the face of the earth, never to come back ever again, men, women, children, the old as well as the young. What's your insight on that? Stephen.
Oh, well, I think the drone attacks and solo just our presence in these countries, our military presence compounded by these hideous drone attacks, these unmanned aircraft that are dropping bombs and mostly killing civilians. I mean, this the combination of it all makes a marvelous recruiting tool for people who want to strike back at us. But I honest to goodness believe that's part of our plan. The only way that this country can convince the U.S. public that it's justified to go after these people and to have wars with these countries is to claim there are bad people there that want to cause us harm. And, of course, we'll always you've got the backdrop of 9/11. See, I mean, they did it once, and if we don't get rid of these people, they're going to do it again. So we need bad people. We need people who don't like us around the world. If everybody loved us, there'd be no reason to wage these wars, and we literally have a permanent war agenda. When the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, the military industrial complex for a short period, I think, went apoplectic because their business plan calls for war, more war, and still more war. So we had to invent new enemies. Well, Saddam came along. He came right out of room service. But we got rid of him, so, and we're still there, and you know, there's still trouble in Iraq, and that war very much is ongoing, not the way it was a few years ago, but it's still very much ongoing, and I expect it to rev up more so in the months or years from now. I mean, as long as we're there, there'll be a war going on. Same thing in Afghanistan, and the more and longer this stuff goes on, including these drone attacks, the more people will hate us. And they will want to strike back at us in some way. They're not doing it here. The idea that they're gonna come over here and bomb U.S. cities or do something like that. I mean, that's almost ludicrous. I just can't imagine. How are they going to do that? What are they going to do? Come over here with terror weapons or a dirty bomb? And set these things off on U.S. soil? Well, how on earth are they going to do that? I have a feeling that there's going to be another major terror attack in this country, but it'll be just another one of the false flags. So 9/11 was a false flag, and I believe there'll be another one ahead. When and what, I don't know. It could be something worse than 9/11. It could be a dirty bomb. And they'll have to pick one city where they have to do something very nasty to it and harm an awful lot of people, and they'll blame it on people in whatever country or whatever name they want to give these people or whatever country they want to name. They'll falsely blame them for something we did to ourselves to get the public on our side so we can wage more wars.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Lemon.
You.
This is going to be the last question for you, and we just wanted to tell you that we really appreciate having you on the show. and we hope to have you back many more times. And so in your article, The First Great War of the 21st Century, you talk about how it's not going to be just protests in the United States that are going to create real change, but it has to be, you said, strong public anger expressing real demands for sweeping change, accepting nothing less. And so you're obviously talking about not compromising any of these issues and anything that has to do with human rights. And so how do you feel that as a community, in the progressive community, we can, you know, jumpstart this? And what do we need to do specifically besides just talking about it to create some change in the United States?
Oh, I say this over and over again, including on my own program, that the change, the kind of change that everybody listening to this broadcast wants, and I certainly want it, and the great majority of people in this country want it, a real constructive social change with a government that serves everybody, not just a tiny elite segment of the population. This kind of change never, never comes from the top down. It only comes when enough people, and it doesn't have to be anywhere near a majority, just enough committed people decide that they're fed up with what's going on, and they're going to do something about it, and they're going to work actively. Again, it's not going out in the street protesting. It isn't complaining to your neighbor. It isn't even understanding what the problems are. But it begins with understanding, and most people in the country don't. They may have a sense that things aren't the way they want them to be, but they don't have the real understanding of just how bad things are. And the second part of that is knowing that the only way it's going to change is if we do something about it. Well, I want to see what I would call some sort of a nonviolent revolution. And Thomas Jefferson believed in that. He believed that the country changes over time, and whatever system we had at a moment in time, maybe a generation later the country has changed and things have changed. So he believed that every generation we needed a revolution, and he didn't mean a violent one. He just meant changing the system, shaking it up, and redesigning it to update it to the current situation. Well, he was a member of the elitist class, so he had his own ideas in mind, which was not the kind of democracy we have in mind. But nonetheless, we really need a revolution, a nonviolent one, but I believe we need civil disobedience. And think of the few times in this country's history when this happened and we got real change, and several stand out for me. One of them was the most recent one in my lifetime back in the 50s and the 60s, and that was the Civil Rights Movement. And it took a lot of people for a lot of years struggling, suffering, going to jail. Some of them were killed. I mean, they really went through some very mean and nasty times. And this didn't just happen in the South. It really happened across the country. But there was determination by enough people to decide that they just did not want the old system anymore. They wanted something new. And it grew to such a point, and a key ingredient of that was, of course, there was a marvelous leader that we don't have today, Martin Luther King. I mean, if we only had a Martin Luther King today to be rallying people for the kind of things that he did back then, because he paid for it with his life. But we need a charismatic leader. And we need enough people convinced that it's going to be up to us to change things, and we just have to get out there and do it, even if it means we're going to get beaten up, some of us are going to be in prison, some of us are going to be killed because these people are very nasty. But the civil rights fighters went through this, and they did it, and they won civil rights. Unfortunately, most of them have eroded since, but they won some wonderful changes. The U.S. labor movement was another example. Working people went through hell for decades, until they finally won rights during the Great Depression. The wonderful 1935 Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, that for the first time ever in the history of this country, let labor negotiate it on a level playing field with management. Well, it never was completely level, but it was a lot more level then than it is now. And these rights have eroded because people didn't keep pressing to keep the rights they won. But it took long, painful struggles, by committed people to achieve these wonderful rights. Women, my God, it took women 100 years to get the right to vote that was in, I forget which amendment, one of the later amendments to the Constitution, that finally gave women the right to vote around 1920. But the wonderful founders, Washington and the rest of them, they didn't think that women ought to have the right to vote. Well, what kind of a democracy doesn't let men and women have equal rights? Well, they did. They didn't design it that way. But women, after a long struggle, and that was really a small group of committed suffragettes, and they finally won the right for women to vote. We can win anything if enough of us decide this is what we want and we're going for it. Can I end with a marvelous quote by I. F. Stone, and I don't have the exact quote, but he made a wonderful, the former muckraking journalist. I've used it a couple of times, and he said something, it was a long quote. He said something like, the only battles worth fighting for, this just really, it chills me just to think about it. The only battles worth fighting for are the ones you know you're going to lose. Because if you fight these battles, then maybe someday, after you're long gone, you'll inspire others to keep fighting these battles, and one day they're going to win because of the battles that you fought today. So I put this out to your listeners and to my own. We've got to fight these battles today, even knowing we're going to lose them, because we'll inspire others to keep fighting them, and one day, if we have enough time, hopefully, we'll win those battles. And if we want a better country that's a decent place for everybody to live in, then we damn well better start fighting these battles, because if we don't, we'll never get it. Because if I can say it over the year, I say it on my own program, because these bastards running the country are committed not to giving it to us. They want to steal our rights. They want to steal our money. They want to steal our humanity. And they may even want to steal our lives. And we have to fight back to stop them. I feel so strongly about that. I've devoted my senior years to doing this, sticking my neck out. Well, if I go down, it's going to be on my feet. It will never be on my knees. So I'm in the fight for keeps.
Wow.
Right on, right on.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much. And as Andrea said, you know, Stephen, we hope to have you on many, many more times, because you are such a prolific writer that I think it's so important to have you on our, you know, programs like ours to deconstruct, to fully, not for a little quick 7 to 10 minute interviews, but long interviews like we just had, to deconstruct your analysis, what you've researched and what you've written about. So I really hope to have you on many, many more times. And if you could, before you leave, can you let folks know about your radio show, and also how they might contact you, your email, if you want to give it out over the air to our listeners?
Oh, absolutely. I really appreciate you letting me do that, Solo. Let me just say this about my email. My email address is lendmanstephen, L-E-N-D-M-A-N, at sbcglobal.net. But I'll make it easy for listeners. I put my email address on the bottom of every article I write. So, and listeners can find all my articles that I keep in chronological order on my blog site, which is Steve Lendman blog, or just Google Lendman, which is what I do, Lendman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N, and all my articles are there in chronological order. On the bottom is my email address, and also information on my radio program, which is called the Progressive Radio News Hour. It's on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and it is three times a week, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Today and tomorrow at noon U.S. Central Time, I'll be on for an hour. And today I've got Kathy Kelly on the program. I like one guest on my program, too, for a long discussion. Kathy Kelly is coming on. She just came back from Afghanistan some weeks ago. So we'll talk about her trip over there, and we'll also talk about other things going on in the Middle East. And I love to feature one guest. On Sunday, I'll have Michael Parenti on the program talking about his new book, The Face of Imperialism. And, boy, is that a timely topic right now. I mean, we're watching what's going on in Middle East, North Africa, and that is the face of imperialism. So and all my programs are live or archived, so anybody can listen anytime they want.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, and definitely. And for our listeners, I'm going to soon be linking Mr. Lindman's radio show and his blog to our homepage, so you can soon, you know, within the next couple of days, be able to link up to his radio show directly from our site as well. So we want to thank you again, Mr. Lindman, and look forward to talking to you once again.
Oh, Sully, it was my pleasure, and I am most comfortable when people call me Steve.
Okay.
Even at age 76, when somebody calls me Mr. Lindman, I turn around and think they're talking about my father, who I think would be about 120 years old if he was alive today.
Right. Fair enough, Steve. All right, take care.
Oh, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Sully. Thank you, Andrea.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was a great interview, Andrea. That was right on time, Andrea. That was right on time. And let's have a brief musical interlude, and then let's deconstruct after this non-elevator music that I'm about to play the interview that we just had. So, folks, we're gonna have a brief musical interlude and. You know, we'll see you in about 3.5 minutes. But as I said, this is not elevator music. I would like it to be elevator music, but no, this is not elevator music. So this is Left 4 Dead by Sheepy.
Brother, one Sheepy wonder. Listen, we're all a part of the bigger plan. You wanna stand by yourself or take a stand? Shit, I guess we all have been misled, cause what they say might just fuck with your head. Now the word is out in 91,000 documents, so I don't need to speak the truth about the government. The results are secondary evil, and the orders that kill innocent people. Rapid machine gun fire spit, Apache chopper hit and keep on shooting. I call them killers in the cockpit. The world's sick, we all have to admit. We aim to kill and shoot with a trigger itch. We're going down, I can see people dying. Can't you see all the bodies multiplying? Can't you hear the women and children crying? Are you blind, motherfucker? Can't you see we need to wake up? Let's wage against the machine, cause this is not a fantasy, this is not a dream. This is a reality, this is what we see. And if you think you're free, I beg to disagree. I guess we're sleeping with our minds closed, eyes shut, cold inside and afraid to wake up. We walk around like zombies left for dead, and when we speak our mind, they shoot us in the head. I guess we're stupid and easy to trick. We go to war for our freedom when it's all politics. So we walk around like zombies left for dead. Let me speak my mind and catch a bullet in my head.
A rhyming God speaking. You need to wake up, no Tylenol, PM. The revolution, a better solution. Restitution, retribution, Texas shooting. Death is ruined, better music than your generation. Sinners, hatred, litigation. Kill the nation, winners, patrons. The displacement, wicked sensation. The tempest is timid when he entered the oasis. I have met with the oracle, speech was rhetorical. In the morning, they are mourning you, it is honorable. So when you fight for what you believe, you are remembered by a mark on the sleeve. The funeral parlor, consuming the horror. We move for tomorrow, and usually proper, consuming your offer to the tomb where they brought us. You can't kill a thought, you can't kill an idea. You can shoot me in the head, but can't kill my mind either. The rhyme seeker, divine speaker, time reacher, line preacher, designed to seek ya. Follow us down the path of the righteous. If you don't like us, from darkness to where light is.
I guess we're sleeping with our minds closed, eyes shut, cold inside and afraid to wake up. We walk around like zombies left for dead, and when we speak our mind, they shoot us in the head. I guess we're stupid. Easy to trick, we go to war for our freedom when it's all politics. So we walk around like zombies left for dead. Let me speak my mind and catch a bullet in my head.
And that was CB. This is direct from Norway, Left for Dead. And I just thought, and I played the song before, but I just thought it was one of the more perfect songs that just kind of jumped out at me, you know, on the Rolodex of songs that we have to play, you know, in relationship to the interview that we just conducted with Stephen Lindman. And Andrea, I mean, I thought that Stephen was very, very cogent in his responses. It was well thought out. You could tell that he spent a lot of time researching this, and it was quite frankly an analysis and perspective that we really, I mean, it's you know, if folks were listening, if they, you know, and I think most of our listeners are pretty savvy. I think that's why they tune into the show each week. But those folks that may have just stumbled onto the show and have not taken the blue pill, that interview right there should have been the blue pill right there for anyone to wake the hell up and to understand, like, you know, listen, this, number one, this is not a game, but you're being treated like a game. You're being treated as a pawn, and that's why the information that you just got is not readily or ever put out there, period, and certainly not in that perspective in any corporate or mainstream so-called media outlet. And, you know, we got to realize this. And Andrea, and you know, lastly, what he said at the end was one of the most powerful things that he said, you know.
Yeah.
And we've had this conversation many times off air, is that, you know, the only way this is going to stop is if the only way, it can't be stopped by a president, it can't be stopped by some Manchurian candidate like Barack Obama. It's going to have to happen on the ground, you know, on the grassroots level, in community, from community to community to community. People are going to have to get up and have these peaceful demonstrations, and going to have to just be consistent about it. I'm not talking about one demonstration here, but consistent demonstrations that have to be week in and week out. And yeah, judging by the U.S. And the brutal repression, you know, put forth by the police force in the U.S. and we know about the military, unfortunately, you know, it might get violent, you know, on the hands of the U.S. police force, you know, exercising that kind of, you know, kind of regressive violence to try to quell, you know, protesters. But it's probably the only way, you know, civil disobedience and peaceful demonstrations, you know, not just one here, one there, not these manufactured ones made up by, you know, all these different corporate-driven, you know, organizations, NAACP and Yes La Raza, and, you know, and ACLU, you know, coming together as they did last October 10th, 2010, and that big pop in circumstance that led to absolutely nothing. It has to be folks coming together, progressive grassroots individuals as well as organizations, mobilizing and doing the grassroots. I mean, organizing is hard work, you know, Andre, as you know, we're in the midst of organizing right now, you know, around a very important campaign here in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. But it's really hard work, but people have to be committed and have to understand that the hard work is going to bear fruit for the betterment of humanity. You have to think beyond, you know, some of these limited scopes that have been, you know, put before us, and we have to think long range and think, you know, our hard work organizing day in and day out, you know, putting together protests and rallies and marches that are consistent week in and week out is going to lead to this government buckling and lead to people really becoming more engaged in terms of how their money is spent and just saying, you know what? Nah, no more. I'm not funding this. I'm not funding that. I'm not supporting this political party, the Democrats. I'm not supporting the Republicans. You know, let's look at alternative, you know, political parties, maybe like the Green Party, maybe start our own progressive party, getting people involved from all different sectors of life who really want to see real positive change. I'm not going to just put change out there. but positive change, progressive change, and that's the only way it's going to happen, Andrea. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, you know how we talk a lot of times about how, you know, in the civil rights movement, it was only 10% of the black population that was involved. That, to me, you know, was one of the most inspiring things to hear, that so much change could come from such a small group. And, you know, Stephen was talking about that, about, you know, change only comes from a small group of committed people that are willing to stand up and demand what they deserve and, you know, the human rights that we deserve. And a lot of times we get caught up in all these, there's so many problems, the government is so powerful, they have so much money, they have so much control, and all of that, you know, yeah, that's true. But we've, you know, historically, we can look back and see that the only times that anything has ever changed is when small groups of people committed their lives to changing something. And so it's important for us to reflect on that, that it has happened. And that, you know, if you're just, you know, smart about how you attack these issues, you know, particularly the political power and the economic power of a government, you can create change, you know. Obviously, it's not really going to happen through trying to change their minds or their hearts, because, you know, unfortunately, the greed that they have has really taken over their humanity. And so at this point, it's not even about trying to convince people of what we know is right, rather, you know, really attacking what is important to them, and that's their money and their power. And the moment that you, you know, really put them out there for what they are publicly, through these forums that we have, like media collectives, and it's so important that other people start to create their own media collectives, because the more we have, the better the message we can get out to more people. And so, you know, it's so important for us to organize and to really, like he said, understand these issues, because that's where it starts. Because if you don't understand what you're fighting for, you're not going to be committed to fighting for it. But after that, it's not just about, like you always say, keeping it to yourself or just learning for the sake of learning. We're learning so we know how to fight for what we deserve and be strategic about it.
Right. And you know, and understanding is you know, the they say the greatest trick the devil ever played or pulled was to convince the world that he didn't exist. And I mean, and you can apply that mode to corporate media and so-called like liberal media, you know, is, you know, where the greatest trick they've ever played was to convince people that they are actually liberal, that they actually at the core were like not just anti-war but pro-peace. You can't be anti-war and not be pro-peace. You can't be pro-peace and not anti-war. You have to be both. You have to be against something, and you have to be for something. You have to stand for something. And you know, even when we look at the so-called liberal media, I'm going to call them out for the suckers that they are. You know, such as looking at MSNBC. You know, Rachel Maddow, who's deemed as like, you know, one of the most like liberal voices out there. You know, as well as you know, Ed Schultz. I mean, these are two individuals that publicly on air supported U.S. military bombing of Libya. They publicly supported that. You know, publicly supported that on their shows. You know, disgusting. You know, so you know, but when you can throw those folks out there and they're labeled, and people have no point of reference to look to. You know, people can just throw them out there and say, oh, yeah, they're liberal. And that becomes people's barometer for liberal. And so they're like, wow, you know what I'm saying? A liberal position is this, that, and the other. But at the same time, it's also for military aggression. And so you take people who have not been trained to be critical thinkers and have no point of reference, and they start to think that they're actually liberal, that they're actually somewhat like vastly different than the folks on Fox News or vastly different from neocons, you know, because they're liberal on a couple positions, but at the same time, you know, they're for military escalation in Libya, in places like Libya, you know, and it's like really, really, it's extremely sick and disgusting and vile. because it is like a game, and they play the game so well. They play, the corporate media plays the game so well, and they're fornicating. They're in bed, you know, they're in political and economic bed with Capitol Hill. And so this is something that is not extemporaneous in any shape, form, or fashion. This is something that is planned and put planned as a play and put out there for you know, those who watch, the tens of millions of people who watch these media outlets and get news and so-called information from these media outlets, you know, to be, you know, played like a fiddle. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is in relationship to that, is people have to understand that some of the most viable and progressive voices out there are the ones that you will never hear or see on corporate media. They, you know, the Stephen Lindmans, they're not put on there. I mean, for God's sakes, I mean, you can look at, for instance, Noam Chomsky, who has written over 100 books, I mean, his scholarship and reputation with scholarship precedes him. I mean, he's an academic among academics, but he's also been anti-war. He's been anti-U.S. funding Israel. He's been anti what Israel has been doing for decades and decades and decades to Palestinians. But notice, he's never. I mean, he's been invited all over the world to speak, but he is never invited on MSNBC. I've got definitely not Fox News. You haven't seen, when's the last time you've seen Noam Chomsky for a 15-minute interview on 60 Minutes or 2020, Nightline? Nothing like that. Right. Nothing like that. And people, we have to think about these things. All right, this dude is no chump change. This is somebody who is, as I said, an academic among academics, and in terms of foreign policy, he knows it as well as anybody. So you must think, why the hell would they never invite him on there? They don't invite him on there because they don't want what he has to say and the information that he has to put forth to become part of mainstream knowledge in America. They don't, because that, as you said, Andrea, that is the shit that starts to domino the process. It starts with information. You cannot engage, you cannot mobilize or galvanize any population without sound information in terms of why they need to mobilize, why it's connected to them and their families and their communities and their cities and their barrios and what have you. It starts with damn information. And so that is the kind of stuff that would start that trickle-down effect, that domino effect, where people would start to scratch their heads and say, damn, you know, this opens the door to inquiry to this. And then when you see that, that opens the door to inquiry to that. And the next thing you know, people are in the streets. They are, you know, listening to the voice of reason and the voice of real change from community activists and organizations that are really about something. I'm not talking about these clowns, you know, from National Action Network and Sharpton. I just heard Sharpton was yesterday, you know, on his radio show, talking about, you know, really defending the U.S. as the U.S. is not a world terrorist, because the caller called in and dared to say, you know, Al Sharpton, and I see what the U.S. did in Vietnam and what the U.S. has done in all these different wars, from Vietnam to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, as just so much a terrorist in terms of civilians' lives, as Al Qaeda. And Sharpton was trying to, you know, and he was just like, you know, totally dismissive of the caller, and then and basically said, oh, no, you know, that U.S. is not such and such, you know, that, you know, the, you know, the there were black boys that were, you know, that were killed in Vietnam, that were killed in Vietnam too. And I'm like, duh, you idiot. Yes, it was this damn government that sent those poor black boys and poor white boys, you know what I'm saying, and poor Chicano boys over there to fight this imperialistic war for their own, you know, for their own motives, and they were gunned down, you know, and mowed down, and 3 million Vietnamese were killed. Yes, but
right.
So we have to see them for what they are, folks. We have to see them for what they are. We're going to continue, Andrea and myself and whoever else, and the rest of Your World News is going to continue to call them out for who they are, what they are, and the fraud that they are, because if we continue to listen to these so-called false prophets, we will continue to follow and walk down the roads that they want us to. And when you look behind the money, behind folks like Sharpton and these other clowns that they prance around on corporate media and even the corporate media, it's connected. The one common denominator that connects them is the money. They want to be invited on those shows over and over and over again. So they continue to get their stipends. They continue to get their speaking engagements. They continue to get their works out there. They know if they talk like what you and I are talking about, Andrea, what Stephen is talking about, and put that information out there, that will be the last time they go on that show. That will be the last time they go on that show, and then they will be categorized as charlatans, as this, that, and the other, because they know the corporate media has the ability to loop, you know, small sound bites over and over again and to rebrand them as these radicals, and they will not see the light of day on corporate media again except for a caricature and a soundbite that they put on there, they will continue to put on there to demonize them. That is exactly what it is.
Right. Yeah, you know, I mean, you're an expert on media consolidation, but I think that it's important for our listeners to take a step back and think about that. If you follow the paper trail, like, how did this happen? How did it happen that, you know, you only hear certain voices on corporate media? Why don't we hear these other voices? Isn't that what a democracy is supposed to be about? So, I mean, the reason is that what you're saying, if you follow the paper trail, like, who owns, you know, all these different stations, right? Like, GE. So I want you, because I know you know a lot more about it than I do, so can you just real quick, like, explain that so that our listeners understand that how like, it's not just the media is working with Capitol Hill or the White House, but it's corporations that really are running the information that we're getting, and corporations run the government. So, you know,
right?
So
GE is connected, directly connected to the military-industrial complex. GE
right.
is the parent company for MSNBC, and General Electric, as you alluded to, is one of the top military contractors in the U.S. Period. They build everything. They don't just put out light bulbs, but they also build, you know, engines for fighter helicopters. You know, for these Apache helicopters, they build engines. They build all kinds of stuff that is used for the U.S. military and the U.S. military's purposes. And they make tons and tons of money, billions of dollars of this stuff. We're talking about. The military-industrial complex is a multi-billion-dollar industry, hundreds of billions of dollars. And so do you think, you know, and of course, so we're not going to see an expose on the military-industrial complex, because that would be must-see TV, Andrea. The day that we see an hour-long special breaking down the military-industrial complex and how it's connected to social programs that are vastly underfunded or have been completely shut down from funding, and connecting the dots between the military-industrial complex and the fact that we don't have universal health care, that would be must-see TV. But, of course, MSNBC is not going to touch that. Because why? Because that would interfere with their parent company's bread, their dough. You know what I'm saying? Their moolah. So, yeah, so it starts with this information. And I'm glad, Andrea, that you mentioned, you know, the civil rights movement. But actually, it was, you know, it was less than – it was actually about 1% less than – or one about 1%, a little less than 1% of the entire U.S. population that was actively engaged in the civil rights movement. And that should be very powerful to folks. But that was a critical mass. And that, you know, at any given time, you know, in 1967, you know – you would, you know, during any given week, you would see hundreds of protests that were going on week to week. You know, some protests were 50 people, some protests were much larger, were, you know, several thousand people. But there were these consistent protests over and over and over and over again. And we know that we still are fighting for civil rights, and dare I say, we're fighting for human rights. You know, still. And so, Andrea, you know, I want to thank you for coming again I don't know if you want to give people a quick take on one thing, one aspect of the Dream Act that people need to think about as they're fighting for, you know, the Dream Act. What's the one provision that they need to adjust really quickly in 20 seconds or less?
You know, the military provision. It's a part of the Dream Act that they're just trying to recruit. It's an ethnic draft, and it hasn't happened. It's not the first time that it happens in the Latino community, and we see this across communities of color, you know, in the Native American community, in the African American community, and you know, it's something that we need to consider while we're talking about all these wars. Who are we going to send to these wars? You know.
Right. So thank you, and so we'll be with you soon. So if you listen to Your World News, sign up as a listener, and you'll get those weekly updates in terms of when our next show is going to be. If you want to listen live, but you can also always listen on archive. And as we say, please send this out to all of your networks. Send the link out, because knowledge and information is the driving. They are the driving forces towards us mobilizing as a community and moving forward. So for Andrea Zamudio, Solomon, otherwise known to some as Solo, and this is Your World News. Until then, you know, peace and unrest.
Peace.